Oh, yeah, no, I'm happy to. Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
Do you want one of these?
Yeah, I'll point you up. Sure, that sounds good. Yeah.
So you talk about like community just now, and I've been curious. Like, there's clearly like when it comes to like the queer community, there's like, as you say, the most readily assimilable people, and then there's like, you know, like trans, queer youth of color. And I guess I'm sort of wondering, do you think it's useful to like stress that these like polarizing, like these elements of these different people are part of the same community, or do you think it's important to like sort of differentiate between
I don't really, I mean, I honestly find the word community not that useful, although I use it as shorthand to talk in here, but I don't use it a lot in the book because of that. I think that what I'm, and I think it's also, we wouldn't want to suggest that we like know who's the most vulnerable all the time and who's the least, we can make some kind of like list where we have some clear hierarchy. I think it's more a question of, I think I'm really inspired by like the fundamental practice in women of color feminist politics, or this is where I learned it, of seeing politics as a constant process where we try to look at what we're not seeing, where we assume we haven't actually figured it all out, and then we're like, oh gosh, who are we leaving behind, right? So here we are in a group and we're working on this, and who is it who's probably unlikely to be able to get to our meeting, and how could we be working on that, and why are certain people not here, and what might be the obstacles, and how could we change the way we do our meeting and the way we do our work so that we're going to people. So those kinds of process-oriented questions where we think about systems that make people highly vulnerable and think about how it's essential to have people who are the targets of those systems, who are a lot of different kinds of people who may have things in common and also may have never met each other, you know, come together. So like what that, I think one thing that's interesting for me inside SRLP is that, you know, people come to us for any variety of number of problems that they're facing, and they are really different from each other. I don't know that they're necessarily in the same community of any kind, right? So like people have really different experiences. They're from different language communities. They're from different parts of town. They're from different, you know, somebody's here because they're having an immigration problem, and somebody's here because they're being evicted, and somebody's having a welfare benefits problem. And by being together, people also build solidarity. So people are vulnerable in different ways and also learn about each other's vulnerabilities and learn the connections and overcome obstacles between each other. So people also bring all their baggage where people, maybe I'm experiencing eviction and criminalization, but I have like an attitude against immigrants, or I have a, you know, I mean, all right, people come with a lot of stuff. And so it's really for me about imagining ways that however people come to politics, and oftentimes people come to political resistance because they have a need, because they're being fucked over and they're experiencing violence, and they're like, I'm showing up because it's intolerable, I'm showing up to a group or to a service or whatever, and having those be spaces in which their leadership is developed and they're like, you know, invited to participate if they want to, and to meet people who are like them and not like them and figure out what they share. And so because SRLP operates under the rubric of like trans politics and trans, intersex, and gender non-conforming identities are what bring people to us, that's sort of what people share, but that looks so different too. So I think it's, I think you're right about the sort of polarization of the way that I shorthanded it, and I think that I mean that not to be very firm, but instead to imagine a process-oriented method in which we actually have an analysis of white privilege and of immigration privilege and things like that, so that we can know that, like at SRLP, our rules are that, you know, collective membership has to always be majority people of color, majority trans, intersex, gender non-conforming, and at times we've been like, maybe we want to amp that up to 80%. You know, we have conversations constantly, and then we have a next layer. Oh, we realized that we didn't have enough ways for people who are currently in prison to be involved, so we created a method of having people who are currently in prison be part of the governance, or, you know, like trying to constantly see what we're not seeing. Or we had another round of, in like our eighth year, we had like another round of like research and depth building, because we were like, it's, how can we make it easier for people who are currently homeless and have a hard time having consistent attendance at meetings to be here more, and how can we make sure that we find ways to include people in governance who have those obstacles? So, you know, just kind of like that perpetual process, I think, is what I'm trying to think about, but I didn't describe it in a very nuanced way originally. Is that helpful?
You changed the title of your book. Didn't it used to be called Critical Trans Politics?
I want to know
why you changed it to Normal Life.
The question is whether I changed the title of my book and why I changed it to Normal Life. The book had many titles because I don't know if you guys know this, but the author doesn't get to choose it. The original title of my book was Beyond Recognition, which I thought was really cool. But South End Press had too many books that had the word beyond in the title. And then I thought it'd be cool to have it be just called Critical Trans Politics, but that didn't fly. But we ultimately ended up with Normal Life, which I like it. I think it's useful. To me, what it evokes is, one, just sort of the perpetual, constant, daily, normal violence of these administrative systems that people are caught in. Like, when people think about like hate crimes and hate violence, they really think about that moment where someone is murdered by a stranger. And that one of the lies about violence that upholds the criminal punishment system is that most violence happens in that way, when in reality most of us are harmed by people we know and through state violence, right? So that really changes how we think about violence and how we think about solving violence and achieving safety. So I like the way that Normal Life really is about like how every single aspect of our lives has these deep administrative functions that are highly gendered and raced and that are very mundane, and these systems are almost invisible. Things like having an ID in our pockets or having to fill out a form, right, are actually highly violent, controlling experiences, or having to find a bathroom or having to enter any gender segregated space or whatever. So I liked that aspect of it. And then I also liked Normal Life as a frame, because I think that part of what administrative systems do is they try to articulate what is normal and cultivate the life of the population that's considered the proper national population and mark others for death, right? So that frame around sort of establishing parameters around proper life, and marriage is a good example, establishing what proper family life is and attaching material benefits to that and leaving others to death. So that aspect of the word normal is maybe helpful too, but titling is not uncontroversial.
Speak slower in your answer because I won't answer. And you talk about the problem with trying to change the law, and here in Canada we have Bill 79, which tries to include the Charter of Rights and the Criminal Code of Transphobia. And I'd like to hear more on is that something that we should drop as a battle and actually go against?
The question was about putting transphobia in the charter and a sort of anti-discrimination frame in Canadian law. And I have to apologize that I'm not an expert in Canadian law, so I'll speak to it kind of generally. And I do apologize for speaking so quickly. I'll try to slow down. I guess I think that it hasn't turned out, at least in the U.S. context, those kinds of legal inclusions have won us very little. So I live in a state, Washington State, which is one of the states that has gender identity discrimination as illegal in the state. And yet, if you're in prison in Washington State and you get sentenced to drug treatment and the drug treatment facility won't take trans people and it's paid for by the state, and then I call up the Attorney General and I say, I'm working with this person and they can't go to the drug treatment center that you all sentenced them to and that you pay for because they won't take trans people, the Attorney General says, there's nothing we can do. There's a million situations like that. Like, on the ground, it just doesn't seem to do anything. And I think that that's the case, at least in the U.S., when we look at, you know, discrimination against people of color in housing or in employment have been illegal for decades and are just daily realities. So I don't know, I'm not saying that we should stop people who are trying to do that. I think all trans people's efforts at change and resistance are beautiful, and I support people's efforts, but I don't think that law change is necessarily harmful. It just hasn't delivered. And so I wonder if we might either A, think about how to push to make it deliver. What would it look like in my state to have a true, to have the kind of energy that went into passing that law exist to support trans people who are in prison in my state? Why don't we have that? And the reasons we don't have that are because there's something about what passing that law means to people around race and poverty that supporting prisoners, they can't get behind in the same way. and the media can't get behind, and the legislature can't get behind, right? Or there's cities where I've been working with trans activists who are seeing a law like that come into their city. Meanwhile, the city is enhancing prostitution-free zones, which will mean that more trans people are imprisoned more easily, trying to work to survive. So I think I feel like we, part of what the book is aiming at is not shaming or blaming any particular approach, but instead asking whether we, what would our politics look like if we centered racial and economic justice, and if we centered the trans people who are in the most danger, where would we start? And that is a very local question for every community, right? It could be the shelters are what we want to start with here. And you also always try to figure out, you know, where are the political opportunities in your city and where are the crises? And, you know, there's lots of reasons we pick certain campaigns, but there's just been an assumption that we should pick anti-discrimination laws and hate crimes laws, and it's used up a lot of our energy and resources, and it's produced a very white leadership of people who go to the city hall or county or, you know, state capital all the time. And it has just reproduced a kind of set of political conditions that I think have very little promise for us. So, you know, I think that that's the dilemma. And like SRLP, the organization I work with most, we have decided not to support the gender non-discrimination law that people are trying to pass in New York State because it's tied, it has a hate crimes provision. And we think they enhancing the criminal system, which targets all of our clients so intensely, is worse than the benefit of adding this thing that people don't really benefit from in the cities that have it in the state. So I think it's really a decision about how to do, it's a very local decision, but I just think we have to actually get real about that. We actually have to have a strategy instead of just a reaction, which is, of course, we must want these two things. That's what we're supposed to want. So, green shirt. Yes.
So,
yeah.
My question is very specific. How does SRLP fund?
Well, the question was, how does SRLP get funding? Fund itself. We are in that same, I think, dilemma that a lot of organizations in the U.S. are, where I founded SRLP through like a fellowship, through like a grant, basically, that was available to me as somebody exiting law school. I mean, classic, right? Like, let's fund elites to be the social justice entrepreneurs. I mean, the classic, right? Let's have a white lawyer do this. I mean, the whole thing. And so our funding has included always like foundation grants from foundations like the Estrella Foundation or the Arcus Foundation, you know, like to fund gay, lesbian work sometimes, or sometimes we've really tried hard to get funding from foundations that fund like work around criminal justice, which is not my favorite term, or other, you know, particular aspects of our work or health, although it's usually hard because most of them see trans stuff as illegible. But we have a real concern about the centrality of foundation funding and the ways that foundations, which are piles of money established by rich people, right, to direct how they see, which is a very fundamentally like undemocratic and dangerous way to think about social justice movements expanding. We have concerns about the ways that rich people control social movement growth because of that. So a lot of our effort has been, in the last, I'd say, like 8 or 9 years especially, building a grassroots funding base and really trying to figure out all the ways to generate income that are more accountable to our communities. So, I mean, ranging from things like we have like an art show where wonderful artists contribute work who are allies to our communities and part of our communities. And we have grassroots fundraising, just like, you know, sending letters out to people and asking people for funding because we think that builds organizations that are actually accountable to communities in a different way, and also revenue generating things like I speak at universities, and that money helps SRLP continue, and other people who work at SRLP do that as well. So it's that kind of, I think we're in that bind that a lot of groups are in, of trying to always move towards less foundation dependency, but also try to keep our doors open. And it's a real struggle for a lot of reasons, also because people in our communities are really struggling and really facing a lot of poverty. So, and we feel our services are really essential, so we don't want to cut them out. And so I think it's a dilemma trying to figure out how to fund this kind of work. And we also use a collective structure because we wanted to build an organization that could survive even if the funding was gone, right? We wanted to build a structure that wasn't based entirely on staff, but that it was instead a vehicle for building leadership of lots of paid and unpaid people. And then we also wanted to center having the paid staff be people directly from the communities, which means who are serving to collect directly from the client base whenever possible. So figuring out how to build jobs that you don't have to have a degree to have, right? Which is not true for all legal services positions because we need some lawyers as well. So we're always trying to, I think, again, it's that very process-oriented, sorting out all the internal contradictions of this work and trying to find ethical ways to move forward in them. And that means it's been a lot of experimentation. We've made a lot of changes over time. And we've tried to write down a lot of those things too, so people are trying to look at models. And we've modeled a lot of our work on women of color domestic violence organizations because we often found them to be collectives and providing services. So different than a collective bookstore, other collective projects, we were trying to find organizations that had some of the similar dilemmas and necessities of our work. So yeah, it's a work in progress, and our grassroots funding strategy I think is really exciting for us. And part of an ability to also like create community events and have creativity and art in the way that we're trying to keep the work going. And we also use foundation funding as well. Feel free to give tons of money to SRP whenever you want. Yeah.
I was just wondering, when you said about incremental steps, for trans people currently incarcerated, I know a lot of times so many suggestions like putting people in solitary confinement for their own safety seem as bad as they could be good. I was wondering what you thought were positive incremental steps.
Yeah. The question was about incremental steps, and especially when thinking about trans people who are locked up, sometimes people articulate the idea that putting people in solitary confinement or administrative segregation builds safety, and sometimes not, and how do we deal with that? And that really touches on a really important piece. So one of the traps, right, is to do system reform that expands the system and that is standardized. So people are always like, do you guys want us to build a new trans prison? Like, is that what that's what you're looking for, right? And we're like, no, we don't want people to build trans prisons. We don't want to build any prisons. We don't want to add any more beds, right? And one of the really interesting things that's happened in the last few years in the U.S. has been the idea, this supposedly feminist idea that's emerged of gender-responsive prisons. So in California, they wanted to build these gender-responsive prisons that would look more like apartments and have curtains and where maybe people could like have their kids visit or live with their kids. I mean, all this stuff. And really, it was just a way to expand imprisonment in California, but it was being promoted as like a women-friendly thing, right? So this is very classic, and Angela Davis and others have talked about how the whole history of imprisonment is prison reform, right? Prison reform as expansion. So what that means in the day-to-day of supporting individual trans prisoners who are SRLP clients and members is that we find that lots of people who we work with are trying to get into administrative segregation, lots of people are trying to get out of administrative segregation. In some prisons, it's the most dangerous place to be. In some prisons, it's the safer place to be. Like, everybody we work with knows best, right, what will make them safer. And so we really avoid the idea of trying to pass prison system-wide, like within a given state or within the federal system, reforms. Unless they're just reforms about de-incarcerating people, right? So anything that gets people out, we're for. But in terms of how to best imprison trans people, we don't want to get into that game, right? We want to focus on providing individual support to people to make the most decisions they can possibly make, and we advocate for whatever it is that they most want for themselves. Because it's absurd to think that there's a way to be safe in these systems, or that we could have some global reform that would make people safer, short of getting them out of it. So that's a really great example of a kind of trap set up by the idea of declarations of legal equality, right? And just, it's, I just have to say one other thing about this. So in Los Angeles, there's I think they have like the largest county jail in the United States or the world or something. It's really huge. And they have like a part for gay men and trans women. They have like a queen's tank, which is a lot of, jail systems have something like that. And they have a really huge one. And the way they decide who gets to go into this is that these two white straight deputies quiz you on your knowledge of the bars and clubs in the white gay neighborhood in Los Angeles. So they're like, what color is the wallpaper at the Abbey in West Hollywood? What street is this bar on? And so, of course, right, lots and lots and lots of queer and trans people of color who've never been to that neighborhood, don't live anywhere near it. As you guys may know, Los Angeles is a very sprawling city, so there's lots of reasons why you might not hang out in the white gay enclave, besides the reasons why you might not. Right. To me, that's a really useful story, right? Because it's about how whenever we ask the machine designed to kill us to see us and recognize us and acknowledge us, it will do that in whatever way is most racist, is most gender norm enforcing, right? Even if it's enforcing white gay gender norms, that's just as violent. That's still gonna cut redound to the detriment of queer and trans people of color, queer and trans immigrants, et cetera. So it's just interesting to think about the many harms of reform in those systems that of course come from some purported rationale of, you know, relief or protection.
I'm really interested in the ways that you talk about displacing the perpetrator model and displacing putting all of our hope into law reform, especially since like the law reform model and that entire like story of the United States that you talk about is something that is reinforced like everywhere, day to day, in textbooks, in film, in, you know, things that people encounter and then get excited about. I'm sort of interested in like what ways of framing the model of power you're talking about that for people and getting people to sort of have that kind of analysis available to them that like I'm interested in the strategies that you sort of used and that you like to use in talking about it that aren't just telling people like, oh, go read the code, because that's like really, really not useful.
Okay, I'm going to try to repeat your question, but I'm not going to do it justice, so I apologize. The question was something when we're thinking about displacing the perpetrator perspective model and the idea of centering law reform that's so common and so reinforced in film and in textbooks and everywhere, how do we sort of frame that another alternative model and talk to people about it in ways that people can engage with and understand that are not telling them to go read Foucault? That's a great question. It's so funny, in the car when we were driving here, we were talking about, I was saying that I feel sometimes like, this is not really a great answer, but I feel like with my students and stuff that when I'm teaching, that people are like under a spell, like I'm in a film about magic and people are under a spell and the spell causes them to not see what's right in front of them. And then it's like the work of teaching critical thinking that many of us do in universities and also like with each other and our friendships all the time is being like, it's okay to open our eyes and actually see what's in front of us. So I think like, I really feel like people come to social movements to break isolation and to get immediate needs met. And if we actually focus our campaigns on the immediate conditions, like if we were to sit in this room, or a room with less people in it, maybe it'd be a little easier, and just say like, what's going on in all of our lives and what things are really challenging us, we might hear some themes. We might find out that people are experiencing a lot of housing insecurity or joblessness, or we might find out that there's violence in people's relationships or whatever it is. And that and those things, if they become our priorities and then we try to figure out what solves them, we lead to likely more material connections. Whereas if we just sort of try to overlay a fantasy or spell about legal protection, we're unlikely to ever reach those things. And I think that's interesting. Sometimes you hear people give a speech and they're talking about the conditions facing trans people and they're like telling all these horrible things trans people are going through in terms of violence and harm and exclusion from employment. And then at the end they're like, so let's pass a hate crimes law. And it's like, wait, the connection, it's only magic. It's only a fantasy that could ever make me be able to say that's gonna help. So I think it's just about having really deep conversations about that. And that's hard because people do have emotional attachments. We all have emotional attachments to national stories that were fed our whole lives. Like, you know, people have seen that story and it's deep. And so I think part of it is starting with like, so but what actually happened to you and what would actually solve it, right? And so like if they were mean to you and horrible at the welfare office, if we pass this law in the state, is there any evidence that's gonna happen? Or if your family has excluded you from, you know, all the things trans people go through. I just find that usually we can get to a more immediate set of concerns. And sometimes that's like, we want to do a media project, or sometimes it's like, we want to do a relationship skills class in our community or something. I mean, it's all kinds of things, right? It's not even all stuff that targets state violence. Sometimes the thing that makes us safest is actually just making sure everybody has somebody to walk to the subway with. I mean, you know, like there's so many different kinds of things that solve our problems that we know how to do and that are creative. Or sometimes it's like we just need to get together once a week and not be alone. In some communities, people are really experiencing a lot of isolation. So I don't know. I think that like a lot of times it's really just about going to people's material experiences, and that's maybe overly simplistic. But I think that like it's hard because that story is a spell, and what that story just continues to tell us to do is just reinvest in a system that harms you. Reinvest in it. Look to it for answers. And one thing that's interesting, I'll tell you one brief story. In New York, there was a really important campaign that I write about in the book by trans welfare recipients to address like extreme transphobia happening in the Human Resources Administration, which is like the welfare authority of New York City. And so there was this really important campaign about it. And what's interesting was that ultimately what the campaign won was a really basic policy about like respecting trans people in the welfare office that didn't have a lot of stuff in it that we might want to have in it, like you have to let the people have their gender they say they are on their benefits card. We didn't win some of those things. But all that was won was just like a somewhat more surface policy. But I thought it was a huge victory. And the reasons it was a victory to me were about how it was won and about, so part of it is that how it was won was that all these people who were actually experiencing the harm in the welfare offices won it. So there was a huge amount of leadership built and a huge amount of political steam built in the group of most directly affected people, right? Like tons of people learned a lot. People had new relationships with each other. They were fired up together. There was new relationships with allies. I mean, like there was a whole new political formation that it helped produce. And the people who actually need the change most, they all knew about it. Whereas if this is something that like I had won through a secret meeting with the Department of Human Resources Administration or some other lawyer, there's no way that the people who actually need it the most would have actually known about it. So then they made a palm card and they handed it out everywhere. And so people actually were more likely to even know the thing existed for whatever that's worth. And the third part is that whenever you win any kind of reform like that, part of the experience is you're like, yeah, the Human Resources Administration is still trying to kill us all, we know. Right. Part of it is that it's incremental, but it's about building also like disillusionment with legal change. And so people are like, we won something, we get to have the experience of victory, we know we can change shit, and we're not even close to done. And we have all these relationships and we've built momentum, right? So it's interesting to think too about how when that makes sense. And it really made sense in this instance because of the people who were building that momentum and building that steam and building that leadership were the very people who most should be building that and who are highly marginalized, right? Like everyone in the United States hates trans people and hates trans people of color and hates people on welfare, right? So it's powerful when those people are getting together and winning change and articulating a politics together that is shaped by their life experiences of state violence. So I think it's interesting to think about that as well in terms of like how material direct experience builds long-term change, because it wasn't a one-year thing. Those people are gonna be working together, I hope, for decades, and that step was an important part of like a much broader project. So I think that's another piece about this, is how do we have a long enough term vision, and I think non-profitization encourages us to just think about the next grant cycle, which causes people to have very, 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 very low horizons for transformation, and to say things like prison abolition are, you know, impossible, or we can't even talk about that, or that's not politically legible. And it's like pretty much anything that's politically legible right now in United States politics, and maybe Canadian too, is not worth fighting for. So we only want things that are impossible. Everything that's impossible is what we want, you know, and it actually isn't impossible, right? But anything that sounds impossible, that probably means it's worth fighting for, is like kind of the feeling I'm getting. I also wanted to call the book Impossible Politics, but that was also shut down.
I love that you just said
the word
impossible, because I feel like that's what I've been thinking about a lot lately. And how would you describe impossible politics? Like, what is it that
you think about the relationship between law and the impossible? The question was, how would I describe the relationship between law and the impossible? I mean, I guess I'll briefly say that, you know, people often talk about state violence, and they say like what the state is it's the thing that has the monopoly on violence. When the state does violence, it's not violence. When the state kidnaps you and puts you in a cage, it's not violence, it's law, right? It's imprisonment, it's justice. But if anybody else were to kidnap you and put you in a cage, that would be a problem, right? That would not be lawful. And so perhaps the conditions that are produced by having legal systems are conditions that are about conquest, right? That are about pacifying populations and territories and de-skilling us at solving problems together and engaging in the various forms of mutual aid. And so law is about telling us things are not possible when actually they are possible and we do them all the time, right? I just was on this panel with this person who gave a great abolitionist example that I was like so happy to hear. She said, when you go to a party and then somebody you know is drunk and they are about to drive home and they've, you know, got the keys in their hand, you don't call the cops. You're not like, oh my God, a very dangerous crime's about to happen, right? It's true, it's extremely dangerous crime is about to happen. You deal with it. You're like, hey, dude, sleep on the couch, have a cup of coffee. You know, like, you deal with it. You're actually, we know how to prevent harm and violence often, and we think we don't in other situations, even though, so we actually, part of the spell is that we are obscured from seeing our own possibilities. And obviously, not all situations are as simple as that, right? But, and that situation isn't always simple. But I guess, I think that, I'll leave it there, that something about, you know, understanding that what we're told is impossible. I mean, part of the story also of American law and capitalism is, you know, everyone's greedy and scary and they'll kill you, so we need to have this enormous violent state apparatus because otherwise nobody will share and one person will have all the guns. You know, it's like, well, that already is the case. And the most dangerous people are running around, running banks and running prisons and jails, right? Like the most dangerous criminals, violent people, right, who are killing people are in charge. And so we have to imagine that there's other forms of possibility that are obscured by the turn to legal equality and the sort of appeal of legal equality as the saving grace for us. Yeah. Yes.
My question has to be articulate. So I was wondering if you want to comment on how like anti-discrimination and hate crime laws could reduce and play into how the state can regulate trans bodies and like consider trans under the state and therefore lose access to claiming discrimination for discrimination and
Yeah. The question was about how anti-discrimination and hate crimes laws give the state an opportunity to regulate who counts as trans. Is that, am I saying that right? I got caught up thinking about it and then I didn't keep it in my head perfectly.
And how, like,
if
we see what we do with our bodies
and we... Yeah, and how it dictates how we live in our bodies, what we do with our bodies. I mean, I think that this is complicated. You know, in the context of, in the U.S. context, there's an incredibly complicated set of very conflicting regulations about how people can be recognized in our genders, right, that are fundamentally about drastically and violently enforcing binary gender in all forms. So every single different kind of like state and federal agency and every like ID issuing agency has its own rules about like when, if at all, you can change your gender. And so lots and lots of people like can't change their birth certificate, but can change their driver's license if they live in this state, but not if they live in this state. And then they can change their passport, but they can't change those rights. So that it's, and there's a huge focus on bodies and genitals, as you can imagine, because that's really sensationalized for trans people. And there's a lot of, you know, fundamentally medicalized myths about who trans people are, and that we only are who we are if doctors say we are, or if we can afford certain procedures, but none of which are covered by the state. All of that. Anti-discrimination law isn't enforced quite like that in an interesting way in the U.S. because it's more about how the discriminator perceives you, but every way that it's actually read by courts, we lose, right? So when courts try to decide whether, you know, it's a famous case where a woman lives in a state where there's an anti-discrimination law that says you can't discriminate on the basis of gender identity or expression, and then her job says she can't use a woman's bathroom, and then she loses in court. Like, how is that possible? Like, how is it possible that this trans woman can be denied access to a woman's bathroom in a state where this is covered, right? And it's like, this is the thing, like, the law is incoherent, it doesn't make sense, but it will police you, you know? And so, and then there's, you know, this huge range of, like, marriage laws and stuff where it's like, was this person's marriage real? Let's say their spouse dies and they're trying to inherit or whatever, have a wrongful death suit against the doctor, you know, was this person's marriage real? And there's all this time spent on, like, what this person's vagina was like, and that's how we're going to figure out whether their marriage was real. And so you have these, like, fundamentally horrifying, like, anti-feminist body-norming decisions about how this person's vagina's qualities indicate whether or not she's properly a woman, right? And this, I mean, that's, you know, like, that's the name of the game, right? And I think that people have tried to get around that. Like, I think the Americans with Disabilities Act is an interesting way people tried to get around that by writing it to say that if I, as the employer, perceive you to have a disability or if I refuse to accommodate you, then I might be a discriminator. But then courts have made it almost impossible to enforce that. So even when people have ideas, creative ideas, to try to make the law work in ways that more really accurately attach to how we experience harm, A, it's still stuck between two individuals, so it's not going to capture so much of how we experience harm. And B, it just gets undermined. It's incomprehensible, right? So I think it's been a real frustration. And then there becomes like media obsessions of whether or not this is a hate crimes law, because whether or not this person, the media, there's in the, you know, public media, becomes an obsession about this person's identity and what it was really like, and it's very harmful and degrading and humiliating and dehumanizing. So, I mean, in so many ways, I think it's just, it hasn't delivered for us, right? And it's been very divisive, I think, for our communities as well, those moments.
You mentioned in an interview we did about not wanting to advocate for a third gender category on ID cards or gender X that they have in Australia, because at the root of it, this just brings us back to needing to find other descriptive ways that people can fail to fit into male, female, or X. In terms of wanting to strive for the impossible, I'm like way much more of a pragmatist myself and fall into the, oh, gender X could be a good medium term like solution for a lot of people. I was just wondering if you could explain, like, do you really believe that it's possible that a world with based so much on, assault, gender-based assault in so many ways, could actually completely get rid of the notion of gender on identity papers, because it's something that the Virgo in me just is like, you'll never succeed, Mr. Spade.
Okay, so the question was about whether or not, whether we had had a conversation about third gender categories, like the idea of adding a third gender category, M, F, and X, and whether there's a question about whether, from a pragmatic perspective, that's a good sort of short-term solution, and whether or not it's really possible to imagine a world in which we move away from having gender be a central feature of ID. And a few things on that. So one part of it, I think, is that adding more categories, those categories are still going to be mediated by like harmful state rules. So it's kind of, to me, similar to adding like the Queen's tank at the LA County Jail. Like, who's going to decide who gets the X, right? And what if you really wanted an F or an M, and they're like, oh no, you're an X. And then you go places and you've got an X, and people know people like you have X. I mean, like, I feel like I feel like just that particular solution, very hard for me to imagine that really alleviates harm in a day-to-day for trans people, or gets people something like, I could be like, oh, maybe I could dig an X, right? But I think a lot of times people I know don't want an X. They might really want an M or an F, and it just, the whole thing seems like a real trap to me, personally. I just and I want to say too that I also think I'm a pragmatist, right? I just want to say, like, I think having a large political strategy is not unpragmatic. It's actually more pragmatic, because it's really about actually getting things we want instead of only always getting symbolic change that doesn't change things for us. But I think the question about, is it possible to imagine dismantling the use of gender in systems of identity surveillance, we can only have this conversation in the context of the drastic increase in identity surveillance during the war on terror. And it's just interesting to look at the things that's produced. So in the United States, we added gender to plane tickets. So clearly, if we can add gender to things, we can take it off, right? Like, lots and lots of pieces of ID have changed lots of times, and what's happening is we're seeing this drastic, drastic tightening of all forms of identity surveillance as part of a targeting of immigrants, right, and a form of immigration enforcement. So obviously, to fight this, we have to fight that, right? To really understand what we're fighting, we have to fight identity surveillance and, you know, war on terror policies. And to do that, And you know, obviously Canada has there's been recent lots of discussion of Canada's increased development of similarly harmful policies focused on airport procedures. But it seems to me like a broad strategy about understanding, a broad strategy that's critical of surveillance is better than a strategy that says, just count me right, or let's find a better way to count me or a better way to track us, right? Because A, that's going to leave out lots and lots of people, either because they don't want the act or because they don't have ID or because they're undocumented in various ways or whatever, because they're targeted regardless of documentation, right? And it's just not getting at what we really need, right? It's one of those surface fixes that I think strengthens the system without providing relief. So I think like the real question is, what is our politics around surveillance and identity surveillance? And what is our understanding of possibility? I mean, if we lost ground with such recent changes to adding further gendering to documents, and if that's based, I mean, the point of that, right, the idea when they put gender on plane tickets was they're like, well, that's a clear, real category that's really material, right? And we all know that it's not, that actually even US law itself demonstrates that gender is an incoherent category. So how can we break that spell, right? Like, how can we disrupt that framework and move in a very different direction? I think what that looks like to me in U.S. politics is centered in the politics of migration and surveillance and mobility. That's the place to understand that politics, but there's a really bummer set of talking points that have also emerged about transgender Americans and our privacy, and that to me is a very bad, dangerous set of politics that centers an idea of, you know, like a white transgender citizen who just wants to ride the plane, right? And that inevitably will be a system strengthening, right? That's not bottom up, that's very top down. That like will allow a few of us to ride planes more easily and will fundamentally strengthen the logics that produce, you know, war and terror policies. So, yeah.
I was just wondering if you had any examples of leadership development activities or strategies, especially for directly affected communities who are facing such incredible administrative and structural violence.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so much pain and suffering that's involved. And I'm thinking in particular with migrants,
mm-hmm.
So queer and trans migrants. And so if you have any concrete examples or strategies.
Yeah. And so that's one of the areas of research that we've been doing at SRLP a lot more in the last few years, leadership development strategies. Especially with communities that are facing really significant daily administrative violence, and especially migrants. So we did interviews with a dozen organizations that we wanted to hear about their leadership development strategies and how they were working on it. And some of the ones that we heard about, and this is not like a satisfyingly answer to your question, but just some of what I've been inspired by. Some of the ones that we heard about that were really useful were organizations that really produced like concrete programs, like one model that we really liked was the Education for Liberation Project at Fierce, which is an organization in New York City that works with trans and queer youth of color, and they produce they have semester long, you know, Education for Liberation Project ELP 1 ELP 2, and you go through these and you get a stipend to be there, which is really important for people to be able to participate. And the idea is to move people more and more towards the center of being organizer leaders. So starting with people who are just like in the constituency, you know, hanging out in places where they're likely to be being policed, you know, experiencing the harms of the foster care system, et cetera, and to move people into basically these sort of projects where you hang out with other people like you, it's being run by other people from that same, you know, group and set of people, and they're doing everything from like in the initial ones, like learning basic movement history and learning basically what organizing is and kind of what Fierce's campaign has been about public space and policing and sort of learning the basics, and then moving towards learning, you know, how to run the organization itself, and then joining the staff of the organization, sort of basically trying to build member leaders who then build more member leaders, right? And that sort of cycle of moving more and more and more people into the center of leadership. And we read about we interviewed a lot of groups and read about their sort of literature on their various other leadership development programs, which really depend on the conditions of the community, because also leadership development with somebody who's currently locked in a facility can mean a very in-depth one-on-one relationship, and also an opportunity to have governance power over what an organization is doing, but maybe it's all happening by letters or by phone or by individual visits, which is very different than like ELP, where people can join together and come through a process. But we did find that structured leadership development programs were really, really important. And having organizations be able to hire people who don't have skills yet for the job and teach people the job on the job instead of expecting people to already have professional skills. Even just things like email, just things that are unlikely to be available to people who we may most want in leadership. So that there's a lot of varieties of, you know, it's very culturally dependent on the group of people you're working with and what they want to do and what works for them, right? Like, I mean, it's interesting, there's like a restaurant workers organization in the US, and their main leadership development method is that you get, if you join the organization, you can get free access to restaurant training that can move you into higher jobs in the restaurant industry. So in the group of people they're working with, that's a really big pull. And so then people join the organization, and then people have set up cooperative restaurants and done all this stuff, and, you know, done these huge campaigns against restaurants that exploit immigrant workers and stuff. So that, for them, that's worked, but mostly in the communities I'm working with, we're not usually working with like a group of workers in that sense who have access to formal employment. But that, you know, I think it's what's going to attract the people in the groups we're working with. What do people want? People show up because usually because they want something that's going to benefit from them. And then how can they be retained? How can they be feel like they really have a voice, and we really care about what you think, and actually somebody's going to give you a ride, and somebody's going to call you if you missed the meeting, make sure you knew what happened, and you're not going to fall out of the loop. I mean, all of those relationship pieces we also heard consistently in the interviews were essential to maintaining and building leadership of new members. Yeah.
My question is about, and I guess it's more about trying to, in terms of fighting for like intermediate or like immediate in that sort of an engaging, I mean, sometimes can be simpler in terms of fighting for individuals' needs without sort of engaging the law or trying to engage in legal reform. But, you know, when it becomes sort of a collective endeavor, particularly in a model sort of similar, you know, to the working center, very different, to kind of work with the most marginalized, the most vulnerable group of people, and sort of taking that leadership from them, sort of not engaging the law, when it's especially when you're trying to build an organizing model that's driven by them, in terms of trying to not engage with sort of legal reform. And then the other aspect of, like, you know, the kind of the dance with the law is that sometimes, you know, when you're organizing model based on casework, it's like that individual case after individual case after individual case, at some point, to protect or even to defend or to advance people's individual needs and to create some kind of collective strategy, at some point, you do have to, I mean, not legal reform necessarily, from the courts are trying to do that kind of, you know, that policy issue, NGO kind of work, but even from, you know, a grassroots perspective, that would collectively sort of, you know, defend people's individual needs. So,
yeah, that's a great question. So the question is about the balance between people's individual needs and like doing immediate casework for individuals, and then like broader obstacles and broader concerns for the whole group. And what I'll just say about that is I think sometimes legal reform is the right thing to do in that case, right? So if the whole community of people you're working with, you don't want to just defend every single individual lawyering case, you want to actually get rid of the lawyering law or get rid of the, you know, soliciting law, that can make perfect sense, especially legal work or broad policy work that's dismantling. I think that makes perfect sense. And, you know, in Seattle, we fought this battle around the city wanted to build a new jail. And it's interesting that there was a lot of different people involved in the battle about the new jail. There was like the Defenders Association, the defense lawyers, and they are not abolitionists in the way that they're in their talking points. They were like, let's just reduce some of these drug charges that have certain days associated with them, and let's run the jail a little differently, and then we won't need a new jail. So they were kind of offering that. And then there was like the homeless newspaper group that was really articulating like the ways that low-income people and are criminalized on the street, and people articulating like the extreme targeting of black people in the jail and prison systems in Seattle and Washington. And then there were people coming from all these different perspectives on why the new jail was a bad idea, and also different tactics, right? Some of us were abolitionists, some of us wanted to do more direct action stuff, some people wanted to do more referendum. The new jail didn't happen. And I think that it was interesting to see all these different strategies. And also that's policy work in a way, right? It's like about like the budget and the money, right? So it's interesting to me to also think about like diversity of tactics and talking points and frameworks, but I think it was a successful campaign because I really think that the goal was a good one, you know? And it really provides relief to people in Seattle to not have more jail beds. Like, it really means the city can't do more things to fill those jail beds, which is what it would have had to do once it built the jail, right? So I think I think a lot of what we do is try to figure out if there's something we're gonna fight for, like, you know, SRLP is involved in trying to deal with how immigration detainers happen for people who are arrested in New York City and New York State, and we're trying to move our jurisdictions to not honor immigration detainers, and so not hold people until ICE can come pick them up. And that is definitely like, you know, work that's about law and policy reform, but it's also about trying to solve a problem that's, as you said, like a collection of all these individual cases, right? So it's like, I think it's totally makes sense to throw wrenches in big, big pathways to harm for our communities, which can mean definitely law and policy goals, which is different than just trying to pass a policy that says, the city of Seattle loves immigrants or something, right? Which, and meanwhile, we still make sure people get funneled into the immigration prison. So I think it's just about like the strategy piece. And I've been really inspired personally by No One Is Illegal, the little that I know about it, but from coming here over the years and hearing about it, like I've been really moved by how it seems like, and maybe I'm wrong about this, No One Is Illegal has been able to stop major harmful legal action against individuals at times, not just using legal methods, but using like mass protests. Right, so it's interesting to think about, and I've been reading this book, it's part of my a class I'm teaching, I'm reading this book, No Trespassing, it's like a book from the 90s about squatting and stuff, and there's a whole discussion about different rent strikes in the 1960s and 70s in New York City, and they talk about how in some rent strikes, everybody tried to really use the housing court system and try to stop the evictions, and in other rent strikes, they were just like, fuck it, we're not going to court, issue all the eviction orders, and that's actually oftentimes some of the struggles when they resisted the legal channels that would individualize us off, and then it turns out like I have the rent and you don't. So some of the tenants get the eviction, some of them don't, and then we get divided. Some of the rent strikes that just refused to even deal with the court and just said, fine, bring the eviction orders, and had kept up a, like a really, really firm, aggressive, you know, occupation of their own space and refusal to deal with the law, then would win actually larger concessions. Like one example was that these people had won 3 years of free rent. So I don't know the answer to any of this because I think it's very local and strategically specific, but I think that sometimes refusing legal channels that are actually going to divert and divide can be really important, and that you can force change, including a violent legal system, not only through using lawyers and legislation, right? And we've seen lots of that throughout the course of American history and world history, and so I think it's a question of whether or not we're always being channeled into the most state violence-affirming tactics, and whether there are multiple tactics, and we could figure out which ones make sense for the specific goals we have. I think I need a break, so thank you all so much.